A Map of the World, Disc 11.
How did you spend your days? Howard wanted to know. He asked me in letters. He asked me on our Sunday afternoon visits. And he asked me after I got out. In my blackest moods, I might have told him that our mission in life is not to discover our fate as we go along, or even procreate, but rather to fill up the endless gray void that is time. I didn't do much, I used to say. Read, take naps. He thought I was responding like a petulant teenager. I couldn't explain that I was, in a way, being honest, and yet there was a texture, I'd say it was, beyond activity, that preoccupied us even as we slept. Our existence was pared down to 3 meals a day and a shower. And it wasn't so much a question of what we did do all day, but how did we pass the night as well? Because there wasn't much difference between the two. At 10 p.m., we were locked in our cells and the day room lights were dimmed. But it was never dark and the fighting didn't stop. I have heard enough racial insults to tide me over well into the next life, where I have no doubt the battle will wage on. The only thing I told Howard right off was the amusing dream I'd had my first night home, the waking dream that our pod had become a miracle of harmony. That I was like Anne Sullivan, heroic after all, giving the girls new words in their own hands. When I was brought into the pod for the first time, the 5 or 6 women were milling around, looking at TV, playing cards. One was lying on the floor of her cell, shaking uncontrollably. They stopped their games, and even the sick girl raised her head. They stared at me with what seemed at the time to be identical expressions. The narrowed eyes, set in their faces. It seemed to me for the sole purpose of expressing hate. They watched as I walked across the room. They were poised perfectly still, as if they might spring when I made a false move. I was white, weaned on the stuff of Western civilization, and to them old. Someone, they figured, who would topple over if they as much as spit in my direction. My skin had turned from a healthy brown to a light shade of gray in the previous weeks, and the pockets around my bloodshot eyes were sagging and mottled. I knew that people were raped, knifed, driven mad in jails. I tried to swallow, tried to choke down what I knew was the fully substantive thing called fear. While I was in my cell fussing with my bag of books, they began to talk quietly among themselves, trying, I assumed, to think what to call someone as improbable as I was. I lay down on my mat and covered myself with my blanket. If I was going to be like the old hen in the yard, the bird that the others try to peck to death, then I was going to need some rest. I wasn't in the cell for more than 15 minutes when one of them came in and stood before me. She thrust out her right hip and put her fisted hands to her waist. If I'd started reproducing at the onset of puberty, she could have been my daughter. She was a slight girl with hundreds of braids coming from a middle part and falling to her shoulders, and skin that was naturally the burnished, unreal color of a woman in a Coppertone ad. "What'd you do?" Dyshet had the uncanny ability to find out just what she wanted to know. I never did understand how or where she got her information, about 40% of which was accurate, and I often imagined her reaching into the air and grabbing a handful, and then looking at it, at thin air, to learn the secrets. She was unlike so many of the girls who had no concept of life outside of their own neighborhood, who couldn't have said who the governor was, who assumed that everyone spent their lives living off welfare. Dyshet knew far more than the others, and furthermore, she had a vocabulary to talk about what lay beyond her own horizon. When I didn't answer her, she smiled in a way that I nearly mistook as genuine. How exactly do someone like you fuck a kid? She smiled even wider. I know about the birds and the bees, but I just don't get how someone like you do it. You got nothing to put in, far as I can see. What you use? Broomstick? Flashlight? A big old banana? I was surprised by her frankness. I tried to think quickly. I didn't see much point in answering, but I knew that if I didn't respond, I'd be in trouble. Either way, I guessed I was in trouble. I've been accused of sexual abuse, I said. Is that what you mean? Accused? She nodded slowly as she studied me. You nothing but a pervert. Accused, I repeated. She reached out and twisted my braid around hard in one hand, so hard my eyes smarted. You probably think I should be showing you some respect, since you an old lady by now. But I don't take too kind to people who mess with others. You sit and wait, Granny, she said, twisting harder. You sit and wait for me. She let go, sashaying into the day room, singing out in a rich, clear voice, a number about coming into the promised land. I remember Howard wondering on the first visiting day, in a muttering way, how I could be so sanguine. My attitude was to become a source of irritation to him as the summer wore on. Surely he knew me by now, knew that I was someone who didn't thrive on danger, who couldn't live happily on the edge, who didn't seek out risk. I had married him for plenty of reasons, but not least because I thought he offered safety. I'm not really sanguine, I had said, feeling that any explanation was futile. I'm only trying to find the way, Howard. Trying to figure out if I should shut down and play dead, or rise above, like a bony ascetic, waiting for grace. At the beginning, I spent most of my time in my cell with Debbie Clark, who at 18 had had the misfortune to bear twins in her mother's car and then accidentally do away with them. She whimpered for most of the 13 weeks we lived together. It was helpful to me to be cooped up with someone who was so extravagantly sorry for herself. Not that she didn't have good reason. She had been charged with the murder of her twin infants shortly after she delivered them, by herself, in her mother's dusty blue 1985 Bonneville. She had never used birth control for fear her parents would discover the pills. Because she was a large girl and always wore oversized shirts, no one realized her condition. She hadn't been sure herself, although she had an idea that a change had occurred. There had been a thing inside of her, she said, punching at her heart. She was peculiarly unattractive, primarily because she had no eyelashes or eyebrows, and because of an ailment which made her skin ooze and flake. She had the scruffy, sick look of a neurotic zoo bird who's lost interest in preening. It didn't help matters that she grew heavier by the day in jail as she worked her way through bag after bag of Doritos from the vending machine. Although her lawyer told her not to talk to anyone about what had happened the night of the accident, she swore me to secrecy and told me everything she believed to be true. It all started with Jesse O'Leary, the boyfriend, who had skin the color of milk chocolate from his Jamaican mother, and from his Irish father, pale green eyes, the beauty of which was not readily apparent behind his thick lenses. He worked for the electric company as a meter man. She had first seen him when she was 14. She had blocked his way on the basement stairs, begging him to show her how to read the meter, as if she'd always had a burning interest in energy consumption. Sometimes I had the urge to shout at her, to tell her that she was the most magnificent human being I'd ever met, in her own terribly bungled, absolutely narrow and tortured way. In the first 3 meter checks that year, she garnered his full name and the location of his barber, more than enough information to track him down. He lived on Quincy Boulevard in Racine, not too far from her home on Russet Street. She used to ride her bike to his apartment and sit on his doorstep, waiting for him to finish work. When I finally was able to tell her story to Howard, he said he found it unlikely. But I have come to believe in all manner of things, natural as well as supernatural. It was astonishing, Howard, yes, and true, that an ungainly 15-year-old with the nervous habit of plucking her own eyelashes and eyebrows had had the confidence to sit on Jesse O'Leary's welcome mat. Who can say any more what's unlikely? It was nothing short of a miracle that he eventually returned her affection. That he had forsaken her was certainly the most credible aspect of the romance, but ultimately the least important. At any rate, she hadn't meant to leave the babies under the viaduct in a grocery bag. It had nearly killed her, giving birth, not to one, but to two extremely scrawny brown babies. When she was pushing, she prayed that she was just passing kidney stones. She continued to pray even after she heard what sounded like snorting. What overtook her next was the deep and terrifying anxiety of a child. What would happen when her mother found out? The shock of one white baby would have been enough to give her mother palpitations. Consider then the shock of two, and brown. As far as she could tell under the viaduct and by the dome light in the car, which she turned on and immediately switched off, they were the color of horse chestnuts. They had big round eyes like chimps. There was the terrific mess in the back of the Bonneville to consider as well, the car Debbie wasn't even allowed to drive. She had set out along the highway when she couldn't stand the pain. She said driving always made her feel better, although that time proved to be the exception. She meant only to leave the babies by the interstate for a little while. She had planned to come back for them after she'd gone to the Stop and Shop for diapers and T-shirts. But she was so tired and needed to rest, and she knew for a fact that Linda Brewster's parents never locked their basement door. It didn't take long for Mrs. Brewster to put two and two together. There was an inordinate amount of blood in the basement bathroom, a solid line across the laundry room to the storage room. The phone call from Debbie's mother. She was wondering if anyone had seen the car or her daughter. And the news reports on television concerning the dead twins. When I mentioned to Debbie that coping with postnatal blues was bad enough, she continued to produce her seemingly endless supply of tears. "I know," she sobbed. "I wish there was something here I could kill myself with." She used to kneel on her mat with her hands clasped, and rocking up and down on her heels, she'd keen, "Jesse, Jesse, how could you do it? How could you do it to me?" I had my own sorrows, but hers were so noisy and continuous that her specific grief was contagious. I used to sit on the floor and hold her. I found myself crying easily for the babies and for Debbie. At 18, she should have felt that the possibilities for her future were before her in a stunning array. She probably would never again have much expectation or hope. I didn't assure her that she wasn't going to die for decades, that the present misery would probably change through the years and deepen, that the grief would always be with her, like some unwanted person holding her at her elbow, guiding her down paths she hadn't planned to take. She never wondered why she didn't love the babies, but given time, she might ask herself who they had been and what they meant to her. I think she believed that they were still out by the freeway, somehow warm and taken care of, waiting for their shirts and diapers. She never did heave up out of her own mire to ask after my particular brand of trouble. She assumed that I had been set down in jail for the sole purpose of listening again and again to the fairly consistent versions of the same sad story. We were all shut off from the world. But she was especially so because she couldn't get beyond the horrifying details of that night. She couldn't begin to be quiet and think about the nature of her own calamity. If there was one lesson she might have learned, it was that each of our stories was singular, and so riddled with pain, many of us became dull. There were several others in our living unit who were in for at least 3 months. Dichette had been charged with scratching a police officer while she was being booked for possession of cocaine. Sherry had been an accomplice in an armed robbery. Janet, a large white girl with curly blonde hair that came down in front to the end of her nose, and a mouth that hung open, had charges too numerous to count. There were up to 16 at any time, some in for an hour or two while their bond was being paid, some for a day or a week while they awaited their transfer or hearing. When anyone new came in, Dichette, if she didn't already know, bullied their charge from them, and then she sang out into the day room as if the felon were a beauty queen coming down the ramp. "Here she is, Debbie Clark. She do in her little tiny helpless twin girls under the viaduct." She often pointed out our cell to a newcomer. She'd say, "Don't you get too close. The baby killers, they sleep in there." The first trouble took place not more than a few days after I began my stay. I tried very hard to think breezily of my term there as a stay, as if it were a 19th-century trip to the sanitarium up in the mountains, a little room from which I would emerge cured. We were eating lunch off of the yellow sculpted trays, which were plate and tray in one. A slice of American cheese between two pieces of white bread, yellow applesauce, two flabby carrot sticks, and one chocolate chip cookie. Despite the fact that we had many of the major food groups, everything was of the same doughy texture. Dichette came to the table wrapped up in her blanket and sat hunched over her tray. "What this shit?" she said. Without looking up, she said, "Did you know you was about to have them twins?" When Debbie tried to whimper and eat at the same time, there were often disastrous results. She choked regularly, even on soft foods, donuts and jello, so that I, or later Sherry, would have to pound her on the back until the chunk went down. "Hey, girl," Dichette said, reaching over and prodding Debbie on the chest with the flat of her hand. "I'd be talking to you." When she was frightened, Debbie's bald eyes glazed over and she breathed through her mouth like a snorer. "You're such a fat girl. Was you so ass fat all the time you can't tell what's what? You thought them kicks was your stomach grumbling? You got so much flab in them juicy pink thighs, in your sweet little old stomach pink as a pig. Ain't you just pink, Sherry? What you give to be fine and sweet and pink?" For a small, thin person, Dichette had a surprisingly deep laugh. She sang in the shower, couldn't help it. We used to stop to listen, stunned by the beauty of her voice. She sang old Motown hits, songs that were on the charts long before she was born. We were determined to listen, determined not to let on that we knew she could charm us. I used to imagine that all of us shared the secret of Dichette's true power, possibly the one thing she herself didn't know. Sherry was 6 feet tall, with a large frizzy orange ponytail, and skin that was a deep, glistening black. She said to Debbie, "I bet your man thinks you one choice cut. He a fatso like you?" "Uh-oh," Dichette moaned. "Oh, my blubbery little old elephant. You got such a sweet, greasy, tight pussy for a fat girl. What can I do to make you satisfy?" I ate. It was difficult to concentrate on my sandwich in the midst of so much gaiety and mirth. I wished Debbie would finish her lunch and leave them to pick on someone else. Her head was bowed so low she was in danger of thunking over onto the table.
"You making her cry, Dachette?" Sherry said, when she'd recovered herself. "Poor baby. She ain't ready to get took from her mama yet."
She reached over and pinched Debbie's arm.
"We your friends, honey bun.
We here to teach you about all the big doo-doo that goes on in the world, so you be ready."
"We want to know more about Mr. Dick, your man," Dachette said. "He handsome and strong, you always available. Like, over here, Mr. Dick, yoo-hoo, right here, waving your arms. He a nice white boy going off to some hot shit college. You get out of here, you come to Dachette for a little something to ruin his career."
Debbie was under the impression, short-lived to be sure, that crying was a kind of defense. The more Dachette talked, the harder she cried.
"You," Sherry said, turning to me. "How come you don't stick up for your sister? Here we teasing her to kingdom come, and you just sit there like she ain't no relation. What's matter with you?"
Dachette only glanced at me, muttering, "Pervert." And then she leaned down under so she could see Debbie's face. So softly she said,
"Or is it your daddy did it to you? Your daddy visit you in the night?"
Debbie's mouth opened to its astonishing limit by degrees. It took her several seconds to understand what Dachette was saying.
"No," she cried at last in horror.
"Whoa, we thought it was a whale coming up out of the ocean there for a minute," Dachette said, sniggering.
"You awake now, girl, that's for sure," Sherry bellowed.
At night, when I couldn't sleep, I tried to think of all of us in some larger context, in allegorical terms. It was Howard who taught me to look at a patch of ground, a terrible day, the befuddled irrigation rig, our holy roller neighbor, as something more than just the sum of its parts, so that a thing at once is curiously both diminished and enlarged. Dachette had so many qualities it was hard to pin her down. She was joy and beauty, rage and cruelty. I finally settled on nature. The rest came readily. Linnell was wisdom. Sherry proved to be compassion. Janet was stupidity. Debbie was shame.
"Your mama know your daddy visit in the night?" Dachette asked.
She was still leaning forward over the table, so that the applesauce, which seemed to effortlessly issue forth from Debbie's mouth in a single clot, went right into Dachette's eye. Sherry was so astounded she laughed. It took Dachette a moment to register the enormity of Debbie's reflex action. She blinked, putting her fingertips to the substance dripping down her cheek. Debbie herself looked right and left, unsure that she'd done what she was afraid she'd done, hoping that she dreamed it, that she could slip away. She let out a high-pitched whine as she cowered, sinking down and down into her stomach. Dachette licked her lips slowly, luxuriously, as the grainy yellow sauce came toward her mouth. She stuck her tongue out, trying to reach her cheek. She made a smacking sound. Only when Debbie glanced up, wondering if, by any chance, the worst had passed, did Dachette dive on the table. She slid across it on her stomach, upsetting our trays and our milk cartons.
"You motherfucking fat-ass white piece of rat shit, you!"
She struck Debbie and pulled her along onto the floor.
"My boyfriend, he's black like you!"
I heard Debbie scream from under Dachette. Sherry grabbed my shoulder.
"What'd she say?"
"I didn't hear," I replied, certain that the news of Jesse O'Leary's racial composition wasn't going to provide the sudden spark of camaraderie and affection Debbie hoped for, that Dachette wasn't going to make peace because they liked the same sort of man. I slipped to the window of our pod and beat on it,
so that the guards, a hall and a window away in their control room, who were standing with their backs to me, might come and rescue my white sister. Two of them came running in a flat-footed vertical way that didn't gather much speed. By the time they opened the door, another girl, Rita, was on the pile, all of them grunting and clawing. The fight was broken up and the girls were handcuffed and taken off to solitary confinement. Debbie's nose was bleeding, and we were given surgical gloves and towels and told to wipe up her trail. Sherry turned to me as we swabbed the floor. "How much time we got with that dachshund?" she asked. "I don't know," I said. "That's how much time we got to breathe easy. Any time without that girl is easy time." We were more like rats than hamsters, to tell the truth. Sometimes I don't think it would have much mattered who we were. We would have fought in the end because we, unlike the cows, didn't have comfort stalls. At 6 a.m., the cell doors were opened and the lights were turned up in the day room. The guard, from her panel of switches in the control room, also turned on the television to the channel of her choice. We never knew if we were going to wake up to the CBS Morning News, or to Life, Yoga with Priscilla, or Woody Woodpecker. There was always noise and sickness, and always light, so that it was impossible to sleep deeply. We stumbled about as if we were perpetually hungover. Because the jail hadn't been remodeled to accommodate the multitudes of unoccupied and dangerous citizens of Racine County, we didn't have double bunks. I slept on my mat, which was on top of a cement block, and Debbie had her mat on the floor of our cell. When there were more people than cells, they slapped down mats out in the day room. I tried at first to find some sort of routine so I wouldn't so easily lose track of time. It seemed of the utmost importance to mark time, to keep my place so I'd know where I was when, like a shade, I came back to the world. I did sit-ups on my mat first thing every morning. There was no outside courtyard for fresh air, no exercise room, no place except the day room to run in small circles. I read after breakfast and wrote letters after lunch, like a scholar might. I read the books I'd brought along with me. I had thought in those moments while the officer stood by in our living room that I'd need books I loved, books to keep my mind alive, books to let me escape and not think, books I'd always wanted to read. I had handed my full bag to the police that Tuesday morning when they came to the farm, imagining the quiescence and time before me like a wide road that narrows and narrows until it is nothing but a dot forever going into the distance. In the jail, I was often so tired I'd fall asleep mid-sentence and then wake up feeling drugged and wretched. I read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books again, for solace, for the company of old friends. When the good dog Jack was left behind, across the swelling Missouri River, I threw myself under my blanket and sobbed. I knew I was crying out of proportion to the dog's bad fortune and ill treatment, and yet I couldn't stop. The tears kept coming even as I beat my fists on my mat. I was hitting the mat when I realized I was asking a question. It had nothing to do with the dog, not at all. It was Howard. It was about Howard. Why hadn't he come after me at Lizzie's funeral? I hadn't ever wondered before, and I had to sit up with the asking. Why hadn't he tripped through the crowds and tried to help me? It had seemed, in the aftermath of the funeral, noble of him to remain and cover for my inexcusable blunder. It was a difficult job, a terrible position to be in, but he had risen to the occasion admirably. I had mortified Howard. I was far too much for him, like a daily dose of strong medicine that makes a person sputter and gag. He had had to stand in line at church, shamed, while everyone stared at him.
how like him to take the blows without batting an eyelash. But if he had come after me, if he had caught up with me, and if we had climbed into the woods and lain in the dry earth together, disregarding the community that was set to pillory us, if he had been able to apologize for the thousands of times he had unthinkingly belittled me, made me feel that he knew best, that I was just off-center, just enough to the left to be, and he never would have said, but he had thought it, unreliable. How different the summer would have been. He thought I was one way when we first met, and I had gone and surprised him by being someone altogether different. He had luck on his side, however, because by the merest chance I turned out to be exactly what he wanted. Someone who would show him his own strength and honor that strength. I was increasingly sure, as I sat and clutched my pillow, that the rest of our lives would have been transformed if we'd held each other and wept, if he'd been able to make some sort of offering, some token, a chink from his armor, a word, a shoring up. He was so methodical and even-tempered, and in his shadow anyone would have been erratic and moody. There was nothing for me to do in his presence but sit and yap at the moon, go mad periodically, run around with a sock in my mouth, jump on him, naughty, knowing better, but feeling it was worth it if I could once or twice actually lick his face. He had been betraying me all those years in small, insidious ways, leeching from me what was my strength. "Do you think I should call him?" I didn't have to look to know it was Debbie, back from her self-esteem class. She was oblivious to the fact that I was under my blanket. "Officer Stevens says we have to take responsibility for our actions. Does that mean I should call him instead of waiting? Jesse said he didn't want to hear from me again. But if I don't call, I'm not taking responsibility for my own feelings."
"It means you're alone," I said without moving. "It means you go on without Jesse." It was the harshest thing I'd said to her.
"Oh, God," she cried. Don't tell me that."
"It just means that it can't be different," I said. "It means that until you're forgiven, the trouble is yours. It means you have to hope for exact justice, which is probably the most merciful."
"Stop," she moaned. "Don't talk to me."
I hardly knew what I had said, or if it was true. I was confused and enlivened with the kind of pure rage Emma showered upon us on a daily basis. Howard could never have come after me at the funeral. It wasn't in his constitution. He had had to make excuses for me ever since we'd met, and standing in line, representing the family, was no different from any other day. He seemed never to have forgiven me for myself. He had led me to believe that I was unforgivable, that there was no hope for change. I had thought all along that it wasn't in his nature to judge, and yet in his silence he was judging continuously, always standing back with his arms folded, looking askance. It was so convenient to be quiet, to let others fill in what they wanted about you, while you stood mum. I was sprawled upon our life, gibbering like a monkey, spilling myself out like oil from a troublesome bottle that doesn't have the right lid. I did 100 sit-ups and stretched my limbs on my bed, stood and touched my toes, did 40 jumping jacks, jumped up and down, did an abbreviated version of a Romanian dance I'd held on to through the years, and lay down. I suddenly felt weak with too much inactivity and self-pity and the aftershock of hatred. I remembered Howard cutting a rope that was wound around a tree, setting the strange dog free. He had made us climb a cherry tree first, in case the dog was rabid or fierce. I had loved that in him, that instinctual man force protecting us, taking the fire. I wondered how he was faring, what measures he was taking to feel that he was still protecting what was out of his range. The television was on all day and into the night, and it was by osmosis that I partook of endless reruns of Cheers, The Bob Newhart Show, MASH, Dobie Gillis, and Star Trek. The one happy constant in my life, however, was the Oprah Show at 3 o'clock every weekday afternoon. Linnell, a 22-year-old hooker, used to say, "Oprah, she the fairy godmother. Don't take crap from nobody." Although I have trouble now, remembering the sequence of my jail highlights, Linnell must have come in during the fourth or fifth week of my stay. Ordinarily, she lived on the streets of Chicago, or very occasionally in the county hospital, where she was treated for AIDS-related symptoms. She had somehow landed in Racine, in the company of a brother or a pimp, who'd been up to no good and dragged her down along with him. "You real lucky to be in a place as fine as this," she said of our jail, which had been built about 10 years before. "You come to Chicago, they don't give you no clothes to wear." To Linnell, the week in the lockup was a welcome respite. 3 square meals a day, medical care, a bed with sheets, a pillow, and a blanket. She was wise beyond her years, and I sorely regretted that whatever she'd done required only a week's stay. "I like Oprah," she'd say. "Much better than them others. Oprah, she could be me. I could be her. She start with nothing and work her way to the top. She over the top, Oprah is. She out in the atmosphere. Ain't nobody can ever reach up to touch her. She done fine for herself, and I enjoy that. I look right at her, then I close my eye, and it seem like it don't take nothing to be her. Poof, I be Oprah, just like that. Sometimes it seem like her success. You know what I be saying? Her success is my success. I tell that to anybody else. They get their mouth right up to my face, open it wide, and they laugh half a day. But you know what I mean. You sure do. Oprah, she got fancy things. But I know if she could do it, she'd reach out her hand and pull me up too. She can't because she ain't God. No, sir, not yet. But you know, if she could do it, just reach out and pull me up, she would. She want to do that, but no people is strong enough to take the weight. She want to. And she would if she could, yes, ma'am, she sure would. I sometimes couldn't keep from staring full on at Linnell as she spoke. She was nothing but hollows and joints, her few long teeth spaced apart, looking, set in her translucent pink gums, as if they were about to fall out. The others knew that she was untouchable and wouldn't have thought to strike up conversation or sit close. I tried to believe that it wasn't her illness but her mantle of wisdom that made them stay away. Whenever I began to ask Linnell about herself, her circumstances, she'd say, "What you bother for? I'd be dead before too long. I'd be dead before Christmas." She said so not in a self-pitying way, but as a fact. If I pressed her, she'd wave her hand in front of her face slowly. "They're more to us than our bodies," she'd say. "It just the husk for something that, fly into the air the minute my heart stop. Oprah, she outlive all of us. She my shining star." I used to think that I would go and find Linnell on the streets of Chicago and take her to see the Oprah Show.
I still dream of her sitting on the set, smiling, those long teeth flashing at us in the light, telling the millions across America, "Your big old body, it ain't nothing but shit." I used to wake up in the night, my heart racing, wondering just how long I'd have to walk before I found her. "Let Oprah be the judge," I said to Rafferty at one of our meetings. "Let Robbie and me, Mrs. Mackesy, Howard, Teresa, Dan, Mrs. Glevich, let all of us come before Oprah. Let the studio audience decide. They're nice suburban women, many of them, dressed for a lark. They have common sense and speak their minds." I remember how he looked at me, as if I'd found a new voice, as if I had been altered more than he'd thought by serving time. Although I didn't know Linnell for long, she raised me up. I often wanted to wake her in that short week she was with us, to sit by her side. But she seemed to want to keep to herself. She sat, day after day, on her mat with her bony knees bent, nearly up to her ears, mumbling to herself. I waited for 3 o'clock when together we got lost in what seemed the simple problems of the estranged daughters, the celebrities after privacy, the sexually wayward, the overweight, the underweight, the shoplifters, the cross-dressers, the sick in body, the sick at heart. When someone down in Chicago paid Linnell's bond and she was getting ready to leave, I went and stood by her cell. I started stuttering things such as, "You take care." She was trying to fit her long feet into her tight jail shoes, her Keds, so that she could go to the holding room and put on her street clothes. She looked up. "What you say your name was?" She waved her hand in front of her face in that particular fan-like way she had. "Oh, it don't bother. You keep the faith." She handed me a worn bookmark with the words of the 23rd Psalm typed in a column. At the bottom it said, "Presented to Linnell Duchamps, November 12, 1974, First Baptist Church, Chicago, Illinois." "You keep the faith, you hear?" The minute the door had closed behind her, Dyschette shuddered. "That nigger," she said, "give me the creeps." I remember clearly when Dyschette got out of solitary confinement the first time, after she beat up Debbie. She came waltzing into my cell while Debbie was taking a shower. "Come on in," I said, after she was already well into the middle of the room, right on Debbie's pillow with her dirty shoes. She assumed her characteristic pose, one hip out, her fists at her waist. "You some kind of smart-ass professor, always reading like you the queen?" "I read about other things besides horses and dogs," I said. "So, who's next? Do you systematically work your way through everyone here? I've never been in before, and it would be nice to be able to plan. Are you going to go from cell to cell and insult us and then beat us up?" "Oh, my," she said, her eyes wide, her nose in the air, her lovely long neck extended. "If she ain't going to figure me out, motherfucking analyze me," she called out across the day room. "Hey, Sherry, she one of them mind doctors. Tell me your problems, your dreams, all that shit." She turned to me, coming closer, squinting at me so that I couldn't see the least shine of her eyes. "It kill me, you know that?" She spoke in the most dulcet of tones. "It just drive me crazy how you can't tell nothing by looking at it. I walk down the street past you, think you was the perfect person, you know, with the house, the 2-car garage, the country club, the maid to wipe your ass. I see people like that, and part of me is saying, I hate that bitch. Another part says,
how come I can't be her? And now come to find out you nothing but a pervert.
She shook her head once, back and forth, her right nostril hiked up in a sneer.
That made me crazy when things turn out so different from what I see.
I regret that I didn't have the sense to realize that she was speaking as much about herself as she was about me.
You look like a princess, with your pretty braids, and deep down you a creepy little man after some pussy. That's all you're thinking about. You got the idea you sitting here and keep your mouth shut ain't nothing gonna happen to you, but you got that wrong. The stink of you is flowing out and getting in my face. You just got to sit there and your stink come and get us. Make me want to stab something.
I was relieved of her because someone new came into the pod. Someone whose life history was surely already on the tip of her tongue. I knew from the talk that went on most of the day and night that Daishet had moved up from Illinois with a cousin and the cousin's boyfriend in search of a better life, but bringing along with them their drug connections, reinforcing one of the many crack spokes that fanned out of Chicago. I had heard her brag that she didn't have children yet because she'd had the brains to get Norplant. She wasn't going to be a welfare mother with 10 kids and a project, and she wasn't going to die from any virus. She was everything the others thought they wanted to be. She had knowledge and strength that went beyond theirs, and she had beauty. She had the singing voice that was as potent as love. In addition to her natural gifts, she was rich. She spent a major part of each day cataloging her possessions. She had furs, TVs, diamonds, shoes, earrings, silk underwear, alligator purses. Any item mentioned at table would trigger her memory of her wealth at home. When Sherry said she loved toast, Daishet put both hands to her head and said, "I got me a toaster in every room. I just love toast, too." It was those scores of toasters that made me start to think that there might be common ground for us. She was still a child at heart, dreaming up her house, believing in it, committing to it as it became more and more fantastical, with a toaster at every turn. She was all nerve, so energized by rage, she had a hard time sorting out what she most hated. I understood right off, after she'd left my cell, that I'd missed my chance with her, that if I'd been quick enough, smart enough, I might have been able to begin to know her. Perhaps it was odd that it mattered to me. I wanted her to realize that if she could channel her energy, she could actually make a path for herself. I often had the sensation that nothing else was real but the confines of the jail and the enraged and hopeless girls who passed through. My family existed only in a dream. I came to think that it was there, in the jail, that action counted for something. And although Daishet was far stronger than I would ever be, I understood finally that in many ways, we weren't so far apart. When she had stood on Debbie's mat, I hadn't been able to listen to anything but the drone of myself in order to remain steady and fearless. For a good part of my stay, I tried to think how to get back to the conversation that would reveal and instruct. She told different versions of a particular incident, as if it were a favorite bedtime story. She used to tell it to whomever was currently sharing her cell, and so I heard it several times over that summer. It was about the time she was raped, depending on her mood, by an uncle, a stranger, a half-brother, an old boyfriend. In some of the tellings, she pulled out a knife she happened to have in her shirt and stabbed him as the rape was in progress. She waited for the perfect moment so that he would be dying and coming at the exact same time. When she first said that line, it naturally got a big response, and so she included it in the following versions, repeating it several times in the course of one telling. Sometimes she'd weave Debbie's story into hers, telling her captive audience that Debbie hadn't been so fortunate.
That girl, she couldn't kill her daddy now, could she? And how could she take the poor little babies home to her mama when they looked just like her old man? That night I killed my Sidney. I stole all of his diamond rings off of his hands. Poor Debbie. Poor Debbie. She didn't get lucky and kill her dirty old pappy. The police. They can't never get me now because of the statute of limitations.
It was Sherry who told me what I took to be true stories about Dyschett. About her being passed from foster home to foster home because her mother was a heroin addict. About how Dyschett had been abused by relatives. Sent to the Audi home as a teenager. Sent to a group home. Waived into adult court. Booted out into the world.
I keep telling her, Sherry said. I say, you be one mad sister. And she just look at me, real proud, tossing them braids. She give me that superior look. You know the one. She say, don't no one mess with Dyschett. Don't no one ever mess with me.
Every day I waited. On Sundays I waited for the afternoon visit with Howard. I waited always for Rafferty to either save me or send me to my doom, and I waited hour by hour for the impending explosion. I thought of Job and how what he feared most came upon him. I had never thought to be afraid of any of the things that happened to us during that summer. Through my life, I had trembled before the prospect of numerous dangers and potential disasters. Never before last year had I even vaguely considered the misfortunes that sometimes seemed to be of biblical proportions and at other times seemed like the sort of thing that could easily happen to anyone, as ordinary and expected as a leaky pipe or a stalled car. There was no sound in the large institutional electric clock in our pod, but I watched it occasionally, sure that I could hear the ancient tick-tock, tick-tock, the useless noise of time passing. I often felt like an old woman at the end of my life, sitting on a strange bed in a nursing home. I used to close my eyes and think of the beauty of Emma's long, smooth limbs. I think when I am old, I will dream of the pond more than anything else. In my sleep, I used to see the sun shining down through the warm green water, shining on Emma's creamy, wrinkled hands and feet as she paddled in her inner tube. Even in sleep, I couldn't consider such a scene for long before the waves came up, dark skies, 40-foot breakers, gray bodies drifting like sacks to shore, their gauzy souls sailing up over the water, up and up. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to tell anyone much about the day that started as every one of the others had started, with the lights coming on, and the click of our cell locks, and the bright chat of the television. Although I had managed to keep my distance from Dyschett, staying in my cell and watching where I tread, I was sure I wasn't afraid of her. I remember Howard asking me in the visiting room once if I would let strangers into the yard, if I would stand by while they pummeled the girls. No, I had said. Of course not. He was implying that I was doing just that, by lamely sitting in my cell. I didn't know how to tell him that I hadn't lost the instinct to survive, and yet at the same time I didn't feel much need for self-preservation. That somehow there was a distinction between the two. That nameless day I sat up on my mat and began my exercises. Despite my efforts, I had both lost weight and strength. After 15 sit-ups that left me exhausted, and a few idle stretches, I rolled over and began pawing through my books, trying to determine my appetite. There was nothing exceptional about the morning.
Janet, the hulking white girl, had joined us the week before.
"You," she used to boom across the room. "What you..."
She rarely had to say more, because the offender abruptly dropped whatever she was doing and scuttled away. Janet, like so many of the others, had already spent half her life in juvenile detention centers or prison. That morning, she and Dyschette were playing cards at one of the tables, shouting at each other when their luck turned. Debbie sat on the floor eating Doritos and watching television. Sherry slept. I read Franny and Zoe, and then I brushed my teeth for a long time, thinking about the Buddhists, trying to enter the moment, entering the pleasure of Mint Crest toothpaste and knowing it and experiencing it fully. Next, I took a short nap. In fact, I slept through lunch. When I came to, I wrote a letter to Emma and Claire, dredging up yet another episode of the life we had lived together. As usual, at 3 o'clock, I went out to the day room for my program. "How come you always watching Oprah?" Dyschette called from her cell. "I got my eye on you." She snapped her fingers, swaying to her own music as she moved toward me. "You always waiting for the magic hour. You put them books away and hop out here like some little old bunny rabbit, your bushy tail all quivery." To demonstrate, she bent her knees and wiggled her behind. "You think," she made her voice go higher, "I'm not a racist, no sir, because I sure do like Oprah. She make you feel real tolerant, don't she? Like a do-gooder pervert. Now, Debbie, I understand her liking Oprah, because they both the same size. What you got going with her? Who she have on today? Some queen about to die? Oh, I know. You hoping Oprah announce at the end of the show, you hoping she say, 'Any white trash out there in TV land who do the nasty with boys behind the bushes? Anyone like that want to come on my show?' You could go on there looking so fine, so intellectual. I read books, but I don't know shit about real life. The psychiatrist lady on there will say, 'How long you had this problem?'" I knew all of a sudden that I wasn't feeling right. It wasn't anything specific, wasn't nausea or hot flashes, wasn't prickling skin, nothing even close to boiling anger or clutching fear. The room was closing in on me, getting smaller, all of them getting closer, everything slowly coming nearer and nearer. "You get teary, wipe your eye on a hanky, tell her when you was a child, someone hauled you out by the braids, laid you out on the fence." She would go on for the rest of the afternoon by herself, and to stop that I said, "One of the reasons I like you so much, Dyschette, is the fact that you do all the talking. It's very restful." Of course she wouldn't like me saying that. I saw her and Janet coming for me. And that's when the room got so close it started to go around and around, inch by inch at first, and then faster, faster, the walls, the orange of our clothes, the table spinning and spinning. It was like the old movie technique to take the viewer back in time, the frames whirling around into a kind of vortex before everything firms up again in the peaceful days long gone. I was trying both to think and to keep from reeling. I was saying to myself, "I guess I'm going to let this girl hurt me, if that's what she wants to do." It was the queerest thing, how I felt my head come down hard on the steel table, and all I could think was this: it's important for Dyschette to understand that it doesn't hurt me. When I felt the heat on my face, I was sure at first that I was lying in the sun by the pond. It was summer, I knew, and so there was every reason to be stretched on the sand in the nearly fragrant warmth of the sun. I opened my eyes and saw before me windows,
and through them the golden light of the evening. Even before I realized that I was in a hospital, it came to me fully, that last waking moment. I had sat on my stool at the metal table, watching Daishet rush at me with her teeth bared. She had done something to me, beaten me maybe, cracked my head down on the table. I had let her do that, sitting serenely on my stool. As I woke, I panicked right away, trying to think what it was we had fought over. Never mind the name of this new place or who had taken me away. I would have to know about the fight so that I could explain it to Howard. I had enough clarity of mind to know that the reasons were myriad, that he, of all people, could trace our conflict back to at least slave time, that he could speak of impersonal forces, of manifest destiny, the industrialization of the North, the cotton economy of the South, the balance of power, supply, and demand. Teresa, on the other hand, might say simply that our struggle was as old as cats and dogs. I would have to explain to Howard why I had let Daishet beat me, why I hadn't at least screamed for help. I would argue in vain that I did have the survival instinct, but that, unlike Napoleon, I had chosen not to fight back. Teresa was the only one, I thought, who would understand, who would know that I had begun by good measure to pay my pound of flesh for Lizzie.
This ends Disc 11.